Today, Plumbing the Depths, the DFA Daily to the 20th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The damage which is being done by the shutdown is clearly hitting home. So today we look at some of the latest insights from various sources, and it's really important to get current data. And tomorrow, on the DFA Live event, we'll discuss our new analysis of the impact of COVID down to a postcode level. You can join the session at 8 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, and there's a link in the comments below. But meantime, the ABS said results from their first household impact of COVID-19 survey showed that in the first week of April, around 12% of Australians aged 18 and over with a job were working more hours than usual due to the virus, and around 24% were working less hours. The survey found that the proportion of people who had a job fell by 3 percentage points between early March and early April. And the majority of Australians are adhering to public health guidelines to prevent the spread of the virus, with 98% practicing social distancing and 88% avoiding public spaces and events. And they also found that 17% of Australians were wearing a face mask as one of their preventative measures. And whilst the findings show that Australians are taking a range of precautions to prevent the spread, two-thirds, actually 68%, still remain concerned or very concerned about their own health. Already 2.2 million Australians aged 18 and over have had a flu vaccination this year, with another 12.2 million intending to be vaccinated. However, 4.9 million do not intend to have a flu vaccination this year. And the survey also showed that 52% of Australians aged 18 and over changed or cancelled their travel plans in March. And the Grattan Institute has estimated the impact of the slowdown on jobs in Australia. They estimate that between one-sixth and a quarter of Australia's workforce is likely to be out of work because of the virus shutdown and social distancing. They used physical proximity data, which we already discussed last week, plus a set of estimates by Grattan researchers on the extent to which jobs are under threat in each of the 88 industries in Australia. Their preferred method finds that about 26% of workers, or 3.4 million Australians, could be thrown out of work as a direct result of the shutdown and social distancing. The alternative methods they use produce lower figures, but still they are distressingly high. Unsurprisingly, they found the hospitality industry to be the hardest hit. More than half of workers in the accommodation and food service industries are likely to be out of work as a result of this crisis, they say. The arts and recreation services industries were not far behind. A range of professional industries where people are more likely to be able to work at home are less likely to share jobs in the weeks and months ahead. And they found that people on low incomes will be hardest hit, because the jobs in hospitality, retailing and the arts tend to pay less than the sort of professional jobs people can do from home. And those in the lowest income are likely to be off work during the crisis. They are more likely to be without work, as the highest income workers, as a general rule, the higher your income, the lower your chance of being affected by the crisis. If all of those 3.4 million Australians moved from being employed to unemployed, the unemployment rate would spike to 30%. But this extreme outcome, they say, won't happen, because not everyone who loses work will cease being categorised as employed, and not everyone who ceases being employed will become unemployed. Some will stop looking for work. Some workers thrown out of work by the COVID-19 shutdown will still be classified by the Bureau of Statistics as employed. And they suggest some may only be laid off for a short period, and because some people who lose work will continue to get paid thanks to the government's $130 billion JobKeeper program, and if you're still being paid by your employer, the Bureau of Statistics counts you as still employed. And so their expectation is that only about half of the people out of work will cease being employed, And of those who do completely lose their jobs, that is, stop being paid by their employer, about half will give up looking for jobs and will not be counted as unemployed, perhaps because they have retired or decide to concentrate on home duties. If these assumptions are right, they say, the unemployment rate will climb to about 12% in the June quarter, encompassing April, May and June, the highest rate since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Under a more optimistic scenario, in which more people continue being paid by their employers, the rate will still climb to about 10%, which is in line with the Treasury forecasts. But under a more pessimistic scenario, the unemployment rate could leap to 15%. Whichever assumptions are made, they say, whatever method is used, it's clear Australia is now confronting one of the worst employment shocks in its history. And this raises the question, should we open up the economy soon? Well, a resounding no came from an open letter from around 200 of Australia's top academics and economists. This is what they said. Dear Prime Minister and members of the National Cabinet, the undersigned economists have witnessed and participated in the public debate about when to relax social distancing measures in Australia. Some commentators have expressed the view that there is a trade-off between public health and economic aspects of the crisis. We, as economists, believe this is a false distinction. We cannot have a functioning economy unless we first comprehensively address the public health crisis. The measures put in place in Australia at the borders and within the states and territories have reduced the number of new infections. This has put Australia in an enviable position compared to other countries, and we must not squander that success. We recognise that the measures taken to date have come at a cost of economic activity and jobs, believe these are far outweighed by the lives saved and the avoided economic damage due to an unmitigated contagion. We believe that strong fiscal measures are a much better way to offset these economic costs than prematurely loosening restrictions. As had already been foreshadowed in your public remarks, our borders will need to remain under tight control for an extended period. It is vital to keep social distancing measures in place until the number of infections is very low. Our testing capacity is expanded well beyond its already comparably high level, and widespread contact tracing is available. A second wave outbreak would be extremely damaging to the economy, in addition to involving tragic and a necessary loss of life. Well, I agree with that position, and in fact, I discussed this difficult trade-off with John Adams on our In the Interests of the People channel today. John, in fact, would open up the economy and let the virus rip. I would lock down longer, aiming at full local suppression. This is, in my view, a way to giving a better chance later. Meantime, banks are doing weird things at the moment. For example, CBA says it will automatically move mortgage customers to minimum principal interest repayments next week to provide financial support amid the pandemic. It will be automatically reducing direct debit repayment amounts for all eligible variable, principal and interest home loan customers to their minimum repayment required. The change, which will come into effect from next Friday, the 1st of May, is being made given the current uncertainty surrounding the virus and as part of the bank's steps to, quote, continue providing the financial support home loan customers need. As announced as part of its support package last month, CBA said that the one-off change is aimed at helping to put a little more cash in the pockets of our customers during these difficult times, which could then be spent in the economy. Speaking last month, CEO Matt Comyn said the move would help up to 730,000 customers by reducing repayments to the minimum required under their loan contract and release up to $400 per month for customers and create up to $3.6 billion in additional cash support for the economy. And Comyn added, our home loan customers are on average 37 months ahead on their home loan repayments. Customers will be able to opt out after the change is effective, should they wish to keep their repayments the same. The bank also revealed that 39% of their home loan customers are more than 12 months ahead of repayments, with the vast proportion of these being 2 years ahead on their mortgage. CBA said that the changes will take place between the 1st and the 5th of May, and customers wishing to retain or change their current repayments will be able to change their direct debit repayment via the CommBank app or NetBank from the 6th of May. And CBA added, please accept our reassurance that the decision was being made with the best intentions, though we acknowledge that no one decision can suit everyone. While the other three major banks, ANZ, NAB and Westpac, have all released support packages for their home loan borrowers, including offering mortgage repayment holidays, none of the other majors have said that they will automatically adjust borrowers to minimum mortgage repayments at this time. A spokesman for NAB told The Advisor, we will not be automatically reducing payments for people who have chosen to pay more than the minimum amount and are determined to ensure customers who have opted to pay ahead are not penalised. We understand our customers are all experiencing different circumstances during this time, and we are working to support them with the best solution to meet their individual needs. In this low rate environment, we are proactively reviewing minimum repayment amounts to provide customers additional flexibility, and should they wish to make changes to the repayments, this can be done simply via the NAB app, internet banking, and over the phone. NAB had previously revealed that it had had 51,000 requests from borrowers looking to pause their home loan repayments for up to 6 months, and have been inundated with similar requests from SME borrowers. Westpac has said it will not be following CBA's lead by moving borrowers to minimum repayments, saying Westpac customers have the flexibility of choosing to meet minimum repayments on their home loan or setting a regular amount above the minimum to help get ahead on repayments. In the current record low interest rate environment, there are still many customers who want to set their repayments above the minimum to pay off their mortgage faster. And customers are able to change their mortgage repayment options by contacting the bank. ANZ has not issued a statement regarding automatic repayment adjustments to minimum repayments. However, ANZ CEO Shane Elliott said he did not believe that automatically adjusting repayments was in a customer's best interest. Speaking to the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics in November last year about adjusting repayments following the RBA rate changes, Mr. Elliott said, I have to act in my customer's best interest. And we have taken the view that the default not to change repayments is in their best interest in the long term to repay their debt. And that's a considered view. I don't think it's reasonable to say that our default position should be just keep putting money into customers' pockets. We have an obligation with our customers. We just had a Royal Commission into when banks don't do the right thing by their customers. I feel really strongly about this one. Brokers have been actively contacting their CBA clients to outline the changes and how it will impact their loan repayments over time. Speaking to The Advisor, Chris Bates, financial advisor and mortgage broker, said he understood the reasoning behind the move as the RBA and government are encouraging people to spend money rather than use it to pay off debt. But he thought that the bank should have opted for an opt-in rather than opt-out approach. Personally, I think it's very cheeky that it's not an optional thing, he said. We know through human psychology and behaviour that people just won't do it. Opt-out, that is. Financial literacy isn't that high, and even if they are aware it's happening, most people won't have the self-discipline to log in and reset the repayments to a higher amount once they see their lower repayments. Mr. Bates continued, it shouldn't have been forced upon people without them having a choice. And the broker and financial advisor added that moves such as these risked angering customers because the bank has done something which they have not been asked to do. Banks already have very low trust. All you're doing is playing with people's trust, and there's already a lot of anxiety at the moment, he said. And ANZ said that it will no longer process applications for mortgage protection insurance for both new and existing customers, saying until further notice it will not accept applications for mortgage protection insurance by its branch network or call centre. ANZ also advised brokers to refer clients requesting MPI to a qualified financial planner. The bank added that customers with an existing policy or those who are yet to draw down on their home loan will continue to be serviced. A major financial institution will be on the prowl for more capital. For example, on the 15th of April, QBE Insurance Group announced that it successfully raised $75 million of equity via an underwritten institutional placement. It will also look to raise up to a further $75 million through a share purchase plan for existing retail customers. The capital raising is credit positive for QBE because it will bolster its capital position and provide an additional buffer against potential negative effects of an economic slowdown and higher investment market volatility resulting from the disruption caused by the virus outbreak. QBE also announced a number of initiatives to reduce potential risk to its earnings and strengthen its balance sheet. The capital raise will strengthen the group's capital base, with QBE estimating it will raise its regular capital coverage to 1.9 times from 1.6 times. And NAB announced today a further $1.14 billion post-tax provision write-down in relation to its misconduct provisions and also to do with capitalised software write-offs of $742 million and changes in the value of MLC. And this is putting out the trash, I think, ahead of upcoming results, but it has nothing to do with COVID or indeed the bad debts that we expect to see ahead. Their CET1 ratio will be still around 10.5%, although down a little, and we suspect that they will be required to raise some more capital quite quickly, and we suspect other banks will have to follow too, but none of them so far have really disclosed anything like the true impact of losses, which will clearly start to accumulate now in their loan books. And finally, picking up from yesterday's post about the Fed's actions, the world's largest asset manager has hit back at suggestions it might profit from government contracts amid the global financial crisis. In March, BlackRock's Financial Markets Advisory Unit, the FMA, was hired to manage its first ever purchase of fixed income ETFs, a move that has drawn scrutiny given that BlackRock manages a significant portion of the market. But CEO Larry Fink said there was nothing wrong here. He felt insulted and said he objected to being framed as a bailout. All the issues around what we're doing with governments are based on great practices, he said during the teleconference for the company's quarter one results. There is never any question about supporting just one market. It's the first time that BlackRock has commented on the rather large assignment, the FMA one with the New York Fed. The unit is separate from BlackRock's asset management business and was chosen for the engagement because of its capabilities. The unit played a similar role during the global financial crisis and helped central banks around the world, including the Bank of Canada, on ESG issues. We did not build this with the idea that it's going to be used in a crisis. We built it to help our clients during normal times and resiliency. But I don't think during a crisis that there's any firm in the world that's better prepared to be working on these truly critical assignments of designing programs for assisting our clients. It's something I'm very proud of, he said. BlackRock saw $35 billion in net inflows in the first quarter, while its fixed income ETFs saw outflows of $35 billion. Mr. Fink said the company was well positioned to weather the pandemic that has transformed the world for us all. And he said the investments we've made over recent years in key areas for growth continue to deliver, adding that its sustainable ETFs, a flagship initiative of the company, saw $10 billion in inflows. But I have to say, me think he does protest too much. And as I highlighted yesterday, there are some significant questions about the relationship between the Fed and BlackRock, and they have a lot of freedom with regard to what transactions they pursue, and there are, I still think, some conflicts of interest. But hey, what do you expect? So just before I go, just a quick reminder that our live stream event tomorrow will be at 8 p.m. Sydney time, and you're welcome to join us. Either ask a question in the live chat, or if you prefer, you can send a question through via the DFA blog ahead of time. I look forward to seeing you then. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.